This is Family Policy Matters. This program is produced by the North Carolina Family Policy Council, a pro-family research and education organization dedicated to strengthening and preserving the family. And now from the studio, here's John Rustin, president of the North Carolina Family Policy Council.
Thank you for joining us this week for Family Policy Matters. It is my pleasure to welcome Ryan Anderson to the program. Ryan is the William E. Simon Fellow at the Heritage Foundation and the editor of Public Discourse, the online journal of the Witherspoon Institute. He previously served as assistant editor of First Things, and his writings have appeared widely in the Harvard Journal of Law and Public Policy, the Weekly Standard, National Review, and the New Atlantic. Ryan has been the featured speaker at several of the North Carolina Family Policy Council's major speakers' dinner events in recent years, and he has been a guest on Family Policy Matters on numerous occasions. So we're excited to have him back with us today. He is back today with us to talk about a dangerous piece of federal legislation known as the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, or ENDA. Now, Ryan recently submitted testimony to the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights explaining why ENDA is bad public policy. We will talk with him today about this and the threat that ENDA poses to a number of fundamental civil liberties. Ryan, welcome back to the program. It's great to have you with us again.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be with you.
Well, thank you. Ryan, for those who are unfamiliar with ENDA or the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, briefly explain what it is, if you would, and who is behind it.
Sure. The Employment Non-Discrimination Act, ENDA, it adds the phrase sexual orientation and gender identity to existing federal employment law. To say that employers cannot engage in what it considers to be discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity. Sexual orientation, including homosexuality and bisexuality, gender identity, including transgender identity, biological males who identify as females, biological females who identify as males. What this ultimately does is it stigmatizes the belief that we're created male and female, and that male and female are created for each other in marriage, as if it's an unjust form of irrational bigotry akin to racism. So we have race as a protected class in federal employment law. You can't discriminate on the basis of race. It's trying to say that beliefs about the nature of marriage and beliefs about human anthropology being created male and female is the functional equivalent of racism.
Well, oftentimes we hear these terms, and because they are undefined, as they seem to be in many cases when they come up, that they're really ambiguous, and it's hard for people to get a grasp on the true impact of the purpose behind creating these words as special protected classifications. Now, they still do remain fairly ambiguous terms within the context of ENDA. How does ENDA define the terms, and what is problematic about those definitions, Ryan?
Sure. So for right now, ENDA defines sexual orientation as, quote, homosexuality, heterosexuality, or bisexuality. But then it offers no definitions of what those three terms mean, nor does it offer any principle of what limits sexual orientation to those three terms. We've seen the LGBT acronym grow to include about half of the alphabet at some places. At Wesleyan College, they have a safe space for their extended LGBT acronym. It's LGBTTQQFAGTBDSM. So that's the full acronym at one of our nation's most elite colleges. The question is, what limits sexual orientation and gender identity in ENDA to just those terms for right now? It's true that right now the text of ENDA limits it to those terms, but why? What is the principal reason that sexual orientation and gender identity wouldn't extend to other orientations and other identities? So that's one question. But even given how they are currently defining it, I cite a university, psychiatrist at Johns Hopkins Hospital School of Medicine and a law professor at the University of Notre Dame that just point out that unlike race, color, ethnicity, sexual orientation does not have any objective definition, and that there's no consensus within the social science community as to what it means. Quote, there is no scientific consensus on how to define sexual orientation, and the various definitions proposed by experts produce substantially different groups of people. So if this is going to become part of federal law, it'll be very confusing as to who is protected and under what situations. It opens employers up to quite a bit of liability. So the objections to ENDA have really united libertarians that are concerned about free market, social conservatives concerned about marriage, concerned about sexuality. It's united, you know, various parts of the center-right community saying that this is an unnecessary, ambiguous law.
Well, and in addition to the ambiguity of these terms, when we look at the classifications that have traditionally been protected, like race, color, age, national origin, those are classifications that are much more clearly defined. And so what do you see as some of the key differences between the efforts to gain legally protected status for sexual orientation and gender identity and those classifications that have traditionally been protected by our national and, in some cases, state laws?
Sure. You know, in the testimony that I delivered before the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, I pointed out that sexual orientation and gender identity are both conceptually different from race and they're historically different from race. Let me start with the conceptual differences. Martin Luther King Jr. was entirely right when he said that he had a dream that his children would be judged by the content of their character, not the color of their skin. And one's character is comprised of one's voluntary actions. And so what Martin Luther King Jr. was saying, I want my children to be judged based on their character, based on their actions, not judged based on their skin color, which is utterly irrelevant to their character and to their actions. So while race implies nothing about one's character or about one's actions, sexual orientation and gender identity are simply descriptions for voluntary actions. Race, by contrast, refers to nothing with respect to behavior. So while it's reasonable to say that employers shouldn't make any judgment based on race, because race is always and everywhere irrelevant to an employment context, irrelevant to the content of one's character, it's reasonable for employers, when they think it's justified, to be making employment decisions based upon actions. And so whether it's by reason, religion, experience, many people of goodwill believe that our bodies are essential to who we are, and that this view, maleness and femaleness, aren't arbitrary. They're objective ways that we're human, and that our sexual embodiment as male and female goes to the heart of what marriage is. And ENDA would threaten to make those convictions akin to racism. So that's the conceptual difference. The historical difference is that if you look at what happened with the American experience of race-based slavery and then a race-based system of government-enforced Jim Crow segregation, is that voluntary market forces were insufficient to overcome the terrible discrimination, frequently government-sponsored discrimination against African Americans. But there's nothing similar like that today going on against people in the LGBT community. 88% of Fortune 500 companies have voluntarily said that they're not going to consider sexual orientation and employment decisions. And the financial company Prudential reports that the median LGBT household income is $61,000, whereas the average American household is only $50,000. So the LGBT households are making $11,000 more on average than other American households. So it's unclear what the discrimination that this bill is actually seeking to address. Mm. This looks much more like a solution in search of a problem.
Well, you have written that ENDA, quote, tramples fundamental civil liberties and unnecessarily impinges on citizens' rights to run their businesses the way that they choose. You've spoken a little bit already about the potential impact of ENDA on business, but explain, if you would, how ENDA threatens the constitutional rights of business owners in particular.
Sure. Part of Title VII, which is the Civil Rights Act that had prevented employment discrimination based on race, it says that employers cannot allow speech that creates a hostile work environment. And so if you're an employer and you have employees who keep saying racist things at work, you're liable. And if one of your employees sues you saying that you are creating a hostile work environment, you're liable. So with ENDA interpreted through the lens of Title VII, it would say that people who are saying that, oh, I believe we're created male and female and that marriage is the union of man and woman, that's now creating a hostile work environment for LGBT employees. So what it would do is it would enact a general civility code, which would more or less mean that traditional views about marriage and about human embodiment of male and female would be rendered hate speech. they would be rendered the type of speech that creates a hostile work environment. And so it would limit the free speech rights, it would limit religious liberty rights of many employers and their employees.
So this is something that could have a broad and significant impact on all of us, not just those who think that they might directly confront this issue in the workplace, but it could impact all of us.
It could. So same with the North Carolina Family Policy Council. It's unclear how this would apply to your hiring decisions. It's unclear how this would apply to the type of speech that your employee can engage in. But it runs the risk of saying that when you advocate for family policy in North Carolina, that you would be creating a hostile work environment. And that if you didn't hire a gay or a lesbian or a transgender employee, that that would be illegal discrimination.
Well, now, Ryan, you have warned that ENDA will undermine the marriage culture and our ability as a society at large to affirm marriage as only between a man and a woman. How would ENDA threaten what we have known to be traditional marriage, marriages between a man and a woman?
Sure. I mean, the basic idea here is that it stigmatizes that belief, and it stigmatizes and coerces those employers who seek to live out that belief by saying that that set of convictions is the functional equivalent of racism. In the same way that the law wouldn't allow someone to ever take into consideration someone's race, the law wouldn't allow someone to take into consideration whether or not someone is advocating for or against what the employer understands to be the truth about marriage. It would then also limit the employees of that business to be able to speak during lunchtime or around the water cooler about what they believe to be the truth about marriage. So it says that beliefs about marriage, the correct understanding of marriage as the union of a man and a woman, foster a hostile work environment, because it would be saying that LGBT sexual orientation is a protected class. And because LGBT sexual orientation is simply a descriptor for same-sex relationships, in the case of the L and the G part of it, that's how it would threaten the ability of employers and employees to witness to the truth about marriage.
Well, Ryan, as we close, how important is it for lawmakers in states like North Carolina to resist attempts to pass an ENDA-type bill, not only on the national level, but on the state level? And if you could speak directly to our state lawmakers, how would you counsel them?
I think all public policy should promote the common good of society as a whole. And we don't need government coercion, whether it's in the employment context or in the what they call public accommodation context. That's another area where they add sexual orientation and gender identity to the law. We should just let free markets work these things out. We don't need government meddling in the employment market, nor do we need government meddling in the florist or the baker or the photography business. Let markets sort these things out. If a couple photographers don't want to be taking same-sex wedding photos, the government shouldn't be forcing them. If a couple businesses say that we can't be hiring openly gay same-sex marriage activists as our employees because it undermines our particular industry, let them make their own decisions. Public policy should allow as much freedom as possible unless it's absolutely necessary for government to come in and correct a problem. And we don't see that sort of problem in the case of sexual orientation and gender identity. It's not like the Jim Crow South, where government legislation was appropriate.
Well, Ryan, thanks so much. I know you are at a conference, and we appreciate you taking time out of your very busy schedule to be with us today. I wanted to give you an opportunity to let our listeners know where they could go to get more information about ENDA and also to learn more about the Heritage Foundation.
If you go to www.heritage.org, then that links to all sorts of papers and essays that I've written that explain what's wrong with ENDA, but also a host of other public policy issues.
Great. Well, Ryan, thank you again so much for your time, for being with us today, and specifically for speaking with us about the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. Thanks again for your time. We appreciate you so much being with us on Family Policy Matters.
Sure thing.
Family Policy Matters is an information and analysis feature of the North Carolina Family Policy Council. Join us weekly for discussion on policy issues affecting the family. If you have questions or comments, please contact us at 919-807-0800 or visit our website at ncfamily.org.